somehow cut. And second, after I started writing the lectures, I wrote my first notes on the proposed first lecture. So they're here on this file. And they turned out to be 30 pages long. As you can tell, the second file is the 31st page, which somehow got scanned later. And so there is no way that I will go through all of this. It's just that what constitutes basics of supersymmetry is a very stretchy notion. What I want to do anyway is to discuss in the first lecture the basic property of supersymmetry, its algebra, energy level, supersymmetry breaking in quantum mechanics, the Witten index, and possibly the use of SUSY quantum mechanics to prove index theorems. The proposed second lecture was to discuss basic 4D n equal 1 theories and their superspace and components Lagrangians, and the parametrization of most general soft supersymmetry breaking. And then the third lecture was supposed to discuss non-renormalization theorems, renormalization of supersymmetry gauge theories with matter, the NSVZ beta function, and possibly also running of soft parameters by analytic continuation in superspace. There is no way, absolutely, that we're going to get through all of that. This is a nice outline for a semester-long course. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start today with supersymmetric quantum mechanics and see how far we get. And hopefully these 30 pages will keep us busy today and tomorrow. And then tomorrow I'll see what I'll prepare for Thursday. And I have all Wednesday off to do that. So that was the plan. As far as literature, well, there is that. And there is a lovely book by Wes and Bagger that if you're serious about this topic, you should all get. So that's it in the way of introduction. Please feel free to stop me and yell from the back and ask questions. It's the best way to go. What else? Well, I know that some of you will be bored, so quietly, there are doors in the back. You can walk out. I know for sure that some of you know this stuff. So let's start with some sort of introductory words. Where's the chalk? So what is supersymmetry? Supersymmetry is a new symmetry that relates bosons and fermions. And bosons and fermions are quantum mechanical concepts, so supersymmetry is a quantum mechanical symmetry which relates bosons and fermions. Is this big enough for the back? I can't scale. That's sort of the brief definition of supersymmetry. And it's good to start a set of lecture by asking why. Why do we bother to study this symmetry? Especially in light of the fact that supersymmetry has been studied for 30 years, and there is no shred of experimental evidence that it is actually a symmetry of nature, with a couple of exceptions that are sort of odd that I will mention. In any case, we study supersymmetry for various reasons. One reason, in not particular order, but probably the order is mostly influenced by how I learned about that, is particle theory. By particle theory, I mean theories of elementary particles at energy scales just above the scales that we know. And in particle theory, supersymmetry plays a role in beyond the standard model physics. It plays a role in GUTS, grand unified theories. I should introduce this thing that Gordy Kahn will talk about, the minimal supersymmetric standard model. This is the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model, so hopefully he will talk about the motivation for that. Grand unified theories, so those are basically the things that play a role in particle theory. The kind of supersymmetry that comes about here is typically weakly coupled. Weakly coupled means that those are theories that can be treated perturbatively, and so people tend to gravitate towards those because they're easier to deal with. Typically, but not always. So that's one motivation why we study supersymmetry. I don't have time to go into the details as to why people think that it may be relevant for, say, the next Hadron collider, but not always. So Gordy Kahn will tell you that. So that's one motivation. Another motivation is more theoretical, if you wish, and this is toy models for
for studying strong coupling phenomena. Strong coupling theories, such as QCD, are notoriously difficult to solve. We still don't have an analytic handle on the spectrum of hadrons in QCD, for example, or their interactions. So any new tool that we may have is of some theoretical interest. And so it turns out that in supersymmetric theories, for reasons that we will actually uncover even in the first lectures in quantum mechanics, aspects of the dynamics are easier to study than in other theories. And what kind of strong coupling phenomena are of interest? For example, dynamical supersymmetry breaking. That actually ties into this application, because in order to be useful for particle physics, it is believed that supersymmetry has to be dynamically broken. So any kind of mechanism that breaks supersymmetry is of interest to this kind of application. Dynamical QCD breaking, confinement, dualities, etc. And Philip Argyris will talk about interesting results in those last topics. So the strong coupling dynamics can be both in 4D as well as in higher dimensions. And also in lower dimensions. In two or three dimensions, there are various interesting supersymmetric critical systems, for example, the tricriticalizing model that I will mention later, that are actually relevant to some condensed matter applications. So that's reason B. Reason C, string theory. In fact, this is how supersymmetry was invented in the West. It was noted that the world sheet theory of the string with fermions is supersymmetric. D, that came later, supersymmetry is very useful to obtain various mathematical results. Index theorems, etc. And that could be the subject of a course on its own. And finally, also another reason, it has been historically shown to help in this last venture. So from all these reasons, this one are gonna stay. Okay, mathematical results are solid things. And so it's very useful for that. The last reason, difficult to say how it will progress in the future. Anyway, these are the reasons we study supersymmetry, okay? So what I will start with is to study the simplest supersymmetric system there is, and that is supersymmetric quantum mechanics. I believe that this is the way supersymmetry should be thought. I didn't study it this way. I studied it the hard way. I opened Weiss and Bagger, and I started studying the QCD algebra, its representation, superfields, etc. And there is nothing wrong with that, except that when you go in higher dimensions, there is a lot of indices that come into the game, and they obscure a lot of the simple ideas. And most of the simple ideas are actually present already in quantum mechanics. So especially for the purpose of a lecture presentation, where on a blackboard, when you don't want to write thousands of indices, quantum mechanics is an especially nice field to introduce supersymmetry. And we'll do that today and tomorrow. And the plan is to introduce supersymmetry, the simplest quantum mechanical system that has supersymmetry, study its properties, and you will see, even if you don't see it necessarily in these lectures, that the properties that we will find are actually generic properties of any supersymmetric system in any dimension. So it's a good thing. Let me erase this blackboard and start. So the simplest supersymmetric system is the supersymmetric oscillator. What is that beast? Well, that beast is the marriage of a bosonic and a fermionic oscillator. So let's introduce them very quickly. You're all familiar with bosonic oscillators. You may not be so familiar with fermionic oscillators, or at least not in the word, but you're actually familiar with them. So, Suzy oscillator it consists of a bosonic oscillator. What is a bosonic oscillator? Well, it's a particle moving in a harmonic potential, but for us it is more convenient to write it down in the creation annihilation operators representations. So we have B and B dagger. B stands for boson, those are creation annihilation operators, and they obey this commutation relation. The Hamiltonian for the bosonic oscillator is omega B, is the frequency, h bar is equal to 1 in my notation. B dagger B plus 1 half. And this I can actually also write as omega B times the anticommutator of B and B dagger. And the energy levels, you all know, the energy levels are labeled by... than one fermion, zero bosons and two fermions, etc. So these are the energy levels. And most generally, if there is a level n zero here, this is the level n minus 1, 1. And two is, this is ridiculous. You cannot have two fermions in the same state, right? So this is the energy diagram of a supersymmetric oscillator. This would be 2, 1. You basically just take the two energy spectra and you add them up, and that's what you get. And the only game is the zero-point energies cancels, and the lowest energy level has zero energy. So what do we see? We see a lot of interesting things. First of all, we see that the ground state energy is exactly zero. Then we see that all non-zero energy levels are doubly degenerate. For every level with n bosons and no fermions, there is a level with n minus 1 bosons and 1 fermion. Right? And so you would think that there may be some symmetry that is responsible for that. We'll see that these are generic properties. The ground state energy is zero. E0 is the ground state energy. So this is due to a symmetry which is called supersymmetry. It's responsible for these properties. So what is supersymmetry? Well, we'll just postulate it. There are some operators that I can make out of B and F. One operator I will call Q is B dagger F, and its Hermitian conjugate is B F dagger. By the way, I will take B and F the commute. In all combinations. So there is some algebra here that I'm not going to do, but this operator satisfies various important properties, okay? These properties follow simply for the properties of B and F and the fact that B and F commute. First of all, these are nilpotent. Q squared and Q dagger squared is zero. That's a trivial property which follows from the fact that if you square it, F squared is zero. That's why that's the case. Another important property is that their anticommutator actually gives the Hamiltonian. So please show that. It's a very simple exercise. And another property is that they commute with the Hamiltonian. So let's write that down too. So we have come up with this simple example with a very general algebraic structure. It was not found that way, but it is not a crazy way to introduce it. So let me write everything. So before discussing further general properties of this section, let's see what these operators Q and Q dagger do. First of all, they commute with the Hamiltonian. So when Q acts on some energy eigenstate, the state that you get, unless it's trivial, is also an energy eigenstate because it commutes with the Hamiltonian. So let's see what Q does. Q is B dagger F. So Q annihilates a fermion and creates a boson, right? So if Q acts on a state which has no fermions, it will give zero. Right, because F on this state gives zero. If Q acts on state when there is a fermion, it will annihilate the fermion and create a boson. So if Q acts on this state, it will annihilate the fermion and create a boson here. So it will take this state here. So Q acts this way. Similarly, when Q acts on the state with n minus 1 bosons and 1 fermion, it annihilates a fermion, creates a boson, so it brings you here. Q dagger does the opposite thing. It creates a fermion and annihilates a boson, so Q dagger acts this way. There is a system that has energy levels which are precisely like this. And I don't believe that the fact that this system has this symmetry plays some incredibly important role, but it is just the fact that this is a real system where it's true. So this real system is the lambda levels of an electron in magnetic field in the case when the g factor of the electron is equal to 2. This blackboard space here is just... So the lambda levels of an electron in magnetic field are labeled by, of a two-dimensional electron in a magnetic field are labeled, are precisely these levels, where n labels the orbit, it labels the radius of the lambda orbit, and 0 or 1 is whether the spin is opposite or parallel to the magnetic field. It's better to draw a picture, and I will draw it somewhere. I will draw it here. I will erase this. So 2D electrons in B field along Z axis with G equal 2. These are precisely the energy levels. And it's better to draw a picture. So classically, if this is the B field, the electron runs on orbits, right? Circular orbits, which are quantized. There is an integer quantum number n, which labels the allowed values of the radio, of the radius. So this is the orbit n. This is the orbit n plus 1. And the electron also has spin, which is either opposite or parallel to the magnetic field. And so what does supersymmetry do for this system? It takes an electron on the nth lambda level with spin parallel to the magnetic field. It brings it to the n plus first level and flips the spin. Okay, and those two levels have the same energy provided g is equal to 2, which of course is not true in nature, but it is approximately true. So this is the simplest supersymmetric system, and it's a good idea for you to know that. So when you think of the supersymmetric oscillator, you can think of that. And speaking of real systems, since we're not going to get to that, there is another system in nature which exhibits approximate supersymmetry. And that is described by something called the tricritical Ising model that has to do with spins in magnetic fields and vacancies and stuff like that. It doesn't matter. But it turns out that it is at its tricritical point, the critical behavior is described by some two-dimensional conformal field theory. And that two-dimensional conformal field theory has the same critical exponents that have been measured in a system of, and I have to read that, of a helium-4 monolayer on a krypton-plated graphite. Okay. Whatever. So the critical behavior of that two-dimensional system is described by some supersymmetric field theory. So I believe those are two examples of supersymmetry in nature. And I hear that there are more critical systems that have this property, but I have not studied them. So we came up with this algebraic structure by studying this simple supersymmetric oscillator. And what you can tell is that when there is an algebraic structure, it's probably more general than the system that it was derived in. Okay? And so what we're going to do now is study some generic properties of this system, and we're going to renormalize things so that this omega doesn't appear. Okay? It's annoying, so I'll just get rid of it. It's, after all, just some non-zero constant. So this is the system that we will study. So if I had a system that is defined in this way, which has a Hamiltonian, which is the anticommutator of two operators with these properties, and they commute with a Hamiltonian, then this system has some general properties, and that holds in any dimension, so it's a very good idea to start from this one. So the first important properties is that all energy eigenvalues are positive definite. So for a system defined by this, two properties hold. So by a system, I mean a quantum mechanical system, blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's what I mean. All right? Two properties hold. First property is all energy levels are positive definite. And the second property is that all energy levels are doubly degenerate. With non-zero energy, sorry. So let's study and prove these properties. Okay. And then we'll provide a system which provides a generalization of this simple free system. Oh, one more word to motivate you even more. We have essentially, what we have done is we have provided a realization of any supersymmetric free field theory in any dimension. After all, a free field theory is what? It's a sum of oscillators, right? So you take a field, you put it in a box, you impose periodic boundary condition, you look at the modes, every mode is an oscillator. So to get a supersymmetric field theory in any dimension, you just have to sum this over all modes. Well, you have to add a couple of indices because you have fermions. But essentially, we have done supersymmetric field theory in any dimension, free field theory, okay? And non-free theory, of course, will be a system of interacting supersymmetric oscillators. So in some sense, you actually know what supersymmetry is already in any dimension. So let's prove those properties. To prove those properties, we note that for a Hamiltonian that looks like that, we can rewrite it as a square of a Hermitian operator. How am I doing in time? According to my plan, I have to get to page 15 today. If I don't, it's going to be bad. So, to prove one, the Hamiltonian can be written as a total square. Well, that's obvious because Q squared is zero and Q dagger squared is zero, and what you're left from the square is the anticommutator. So we've proven that. Okay? And so what we want to show is that every energy level is positive semi-definite. So an energy level is something like that. It's a state E, which has energy E. And then these states are normalized. So let's sandwich this between. Let's multiply on the right with the ket, E, and so then we get this. And this is what? Then I use the fact that the Hamiltonian is this, so we get E Q plus Q dagger, Q plus Q dagger E. And this is, of course, the norm squared of the state, Q plus Q dagger E, which is, of course, positive definite. The state either vanishes or it has positive norm. And so what we find is that, what do we find? This is one. And what we find is that the energy vanishes if and only if Q plus Q dagger annihilates that state. So we haven't quite proven. Oh, okay, slowly. I want to prove one more thing, okay? So let's go slowly. So what have we shown? First of all, if we stop here, states are normalized. So by reading this and this, we find that for any eigenstate, the energy is bigger than or equal to zero, okay? But then I want to prove something more, statement one prime. And statement one prime says that E is zero if and only if this vector is the zero vector. So if and only if this is true. And to continue, I will also note that the Hamiltonian can be written as a total square in one more way. I can take I Q minus Q dagger squared. And that's also the Hamiltonian. And that's also a Hermitian operator. Okay? And just work it out. Okay? Here, the only terms that survive are QQ dagger and Q dagger Q, but they come with a minus sign, but then there is an I, which makes it a plus, so this is correct. So applying the same chain implies that the energy of the state is zero if and only if that state is annihilated by Q minus Q dagger. And so combining this and that, we see that the energy is zero. That's an important general property that I didn't mention. If the state is annihilated by the two supercharges. So that's if you wish one prime. So states with zero energy are, because of these properties, because all energy levels have states bigger than, with energy bigger than zero, states of zero energy is called ground states, obviously, and they're supersymmetric ground states. Supersymmetric ground states. They obey this. And one prime can be reformulated that in the following sense, in the following, using the following words. Oh. In a system with unbroken supersymmetry, E0 is zero. Unbroken supersymmetry means, by definition, that the supercharges annihilate the ground state. And we will talk more about that later. So we have proven one. We have not yet proven two. But before proving two, I want to show you a system that actually has this property, which is more general than the oscillator. It will be useful for many things for us in the future. It will be useful first in our discussion of the Witten index and supersymmetry breaking, and it will be also useful in our discussion of superfields, and this is technology which is used to write supersymmetric actions in a quick way. And this system that I will introduce now will be very useful for that. So let's introduce this system before continuing. So I hope this logic is clear. It's pretty simple quantum mechanics. So keep that. This system that I wrote, I believe it was first written by Witten sometime in the late 70s. And it's called N equal to supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And there is a reason for that. Our system. And I will need that, so I will rewrite that. The reason it is called that is that I can introduce new operators Q by simply taking linear combinations of Q plus Q dagger. These Qs are Hermitian. In fact, those are the Qs that I use to argue that the energy states are positive definite and the ground state energy is zero. And the Hamiltonian can be written as a total squared. We've shown that already. And these operators anti-commute with each other. And this whole thing can be written as Qi Qj equals delta Ijh, where Ij is 1 and 2. So the N equal 2 basically counts the fact that these indices can run between 1 and 2. This refers to. And you can see that this algebra has an automorphism, which is SO2. Right? You can do orthogonal rotation on this index, and nothing changes. That will be important in the future. Okay? So now we're ready to introduce our system. So our system is a quantum mechanical system, and now we're going to introduce it in the XP representation. I lost what? Oh, yeah, okay. It's quite possible. And can I not check it? Thank you. Let's check it later, okay? Please check it. There could be a number here, okay? Never mind. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, though. Thank you. You figured it out. And it can be wrong in the notes, I don't guarantee. So, it's not essential, okay? Of course, if you were taking an exam, that would be very essential, but you're not. And neither am I, so it's okay. Okay, so here's our system, okay? So we want to consider more complicated systems with interactions, okay? This is an E. With Let's call them interactions. By interaction, I'll just mean the potential will not be quadratic. Okay? So here's my Hamiltonian. I'll have operators P and X, which will have the normal commutation relation Px is minus I, h bar is 0. And this Hamiltonian will act in a two-dimensional space of two-dimensional, in the space of two spinners. So the wave function will be psi of x, psi 1, psi 2 of x. It's basically like a Pauli spinner. If you wish, the upper part of the wave function is the wave function of the particle with spin up. The lower part is the wave function of the particle with spin down. And so the Hamiltonian that I'll take is this. W of x is some function of x, which is called a superpotential. Super because it's not a potential, right? The potential is W prime of x. But this function determines both the potential and also the spin-orbit interaction, right? This is the only place in this Hamiltonian that distinguishes between the upper and the lower part of the wave function, okay? And so the spin-orbit interaction and the potential are described by the same interaction. In high-dimensional field theory, for example, in four-dimensional theory, very similar formulae will hold. This will be the scalar potential, and the second derivative of this function will give us the Yukawa interaction between the fermions and the bosons. We will see that as we come along. So this is a particle on a line. Particle has spin up and spin down. It moves in a potential which is like this, definitely positive, and non-negative. And there is some spin-orbit interaction. So what are the Qs? Well, I just write them down. Okay, there is a Q1. It was more convenient in this system to write in this basis rather than in this basis. So Q1 is 1 half sigma 1 p. And there is this piece. Depends on the superpotential. And Q2 is 1 half sigma 2 p minus 1 half sigma 1 w prime of x. So these Qs obey, according to my notes, which you check, they obey this. I didn't check when I wrote this, okay? So there could be a factor of two, but it's up to you. So we will, to continue, we will call states with we will call these states fermionic. And we will call states with, no, psi 2 equals 0. With psi 1 equals 0, we'll call them bosonic. Remember that fermion and boson refer to here to whether the spin here was up and down, up or down. So the definition is totally arbitrary. And so this is an analogy with the oscillator. And formally, we can introduce an operator, F, which is just a matrix, which is also 1 half 1 plus sigma 3. And this operator, of course, commutes with the Hamiltonian, as you can check. 1 commutes with the Hamiltonian, and sigma 3 commutes with the Hamiltonian. This is 1, 2 by 2. This operator also has other properties, which you also will check. Okay? Also, and this is more interesting, so F commutes with H, that's obvious. But what is more interesting, that FQ is Q, and FQ dagger is minus Q dagger. And know that I pull a fast one on you. I switch from Q1, Q2 to Q and Q dagger, okay? And I'm also not, this is up to minus one on the right-hand side. So one is plus, the other is minus, and you tell me. So you check and verify right-hand side sign. Okay? One is plus, the other is minus. We call F fermion number. It is clearly something that commutes with the Hamiltonian. That's pretty clear. So now we're ready to discuss this general statement that I made, number two, and that is that all energy levels are doubly degenerate. Using this operator F, we're going to define another operator. Which in this theory is very easy to do. And this will be the operator minus 1 to the F. The operator F has values 1 or 0 on all states. It's clear, right? Its form is diagonal, and those are the possible eigenvalues. So we'll define which will be plus 1 on bosonic states and minus 1 on fermionic states. This operator commutes with a Hamiltonian, just like F, because the Hamiltonian is a bosonic operator, and it doesn't change the nature of the state. The supercharges, however, anti-commute with F, with minus 1 to the F, sorry. So when Q acts on a state, it makes it into a FB state. We saw that in the example of the free harmonic oscillator, right? When Q acts on a state, it annihilates a fermion, creates a boson. But in the interacting theory, it's useful to have this more general definition. And on bosonic states, minus 1 to the F is 1, and on fermionic states is minus 1. So since minus 1 to the F commutes with the Hamiltonian, all states are either B or F. And the Qs map B states to F states and vice versa because of this second property. So we are ready to show that all states are doubly degenerate. We can erase this. So ready to show that all so to every bosonic state, there is a fermionic state and vice versa. Can you see in the back? As time goes on, my writing gets smaller and smaller. But anyway, everything is online, so it's not so important to take notes. So at every B eigenstate, there is an F eigenstate with same energy, and vice versa. So let E be an eigenstate either B or F with energy E. And it's normalized, of course. Like all states, we consider potentials that are rising at infinity. So let me consider this state, which I get by multiplying Q1 on E and dividing by square root of V. This state is also an eigenstate with a Hamiltonian of the same energy. Because H and Q1 commute. But it has opposite, and it's normalized because I divided by the square root of V. Maybe I should do it more slowly. First of all, it's clear that it's an eigenstate with the Hamiltonian, because the Hamiltonian commutes with Q1. And then when you square this state, you find that the norm of this state, if I didn't have this factor, would be E, right? But energy eigenstates are normalized, so you want to divide by square root of E to get it normalized, and this is why I divide it. So this state is also an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian of same energy, and by this, has opposite fermion number. So this proved that all states are doubly degenerate. And there is a homework problem. You show that acting with Q2 on E doesn't give you anything new. And you show that using this F. There is some hint in the notes, okay? So the general story is that the spectrum always looks like it looked for the supersymmetric oscillator, except it's not equidistant. There is some ground state, if supersymmetry is unbroken, that has zero energy. That state need not be paired. It can be paired, but it need not be paired. Because our general argument that states are paired only applies to states of non-zero energy. For states of zero energy, you cannot normalize them, the partners. So the argument doesn't apply. So in general, spectrum looks like this. If these are bosonic states and these are fermionic states, there may be a ground state. And then there are some states, they're not equidistant for general potentials that can look crazy, and they can be, you know, I don't know, something like that. So E equals zero states need not be paired in this BF fashion, BF-wise. E bigger than zero states are always paired. By paired, I mean every state has a partner of the opposite fermion number. So this BF degeneracy does not hold for the equal zero state, as I said. It doesn't hold for the harmonic oscillator. The ground state is bosonic, the way we defined it. And the second important point is that the double degeneracy of the states holds no matter whether supersymmetry is broken or not. So states of energy bigger than zero are always doubly degenerate. Yes? Yeah, but that won't be due to supersymmetry. Yes, absolutely, yes. Yeah, I should quantify. Yes, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, that could be due to some other symmetry. Or in theories with extended supersymmetry, that's the case, but we're not considering those, right? In quantum mechanics, you can have as much supersymmetry as you may want. Okay. So the next thing I want to discuss, so let's pause for a moment. We've been going fast, okay? What have we learned? We have learned that there is this new type of symmetry that can relate bosons and fermions. And in fact, the way we arrived at it was through a simple physical system that actually exhibits this symmetry. This new type of symmetry is generated by anti-commuting operators, so fermionic operators, rather than bosonic operators, right? The algebra that involves the Hamiltonian and the generators of this symmetry involves both commutators and anti-commutators. So these kind of algebras are called graded Lie algebras, and this is one simple example of that. And in this lecture notes, there is no way to discuss the generality of this and so on and so forth. In the beginning of Wessenberger, there are two chapters which, two or one, there are two chapters which I advise you to skip on first reading, but then later in life come back to them, where they discuss the generality of this algebraic structure. So this structure gives rise to some interesting property of the energy spectra. In particular, the energy spectra are always positive semi-definite. The ground state energy is zero if and only if the supercharges annihilate the ground state. We call this state supersymmetric ground states. All non-zero energy levels are doubly degenerate. This is because of supersymmetry. And well, this is it so far. The next thing I want to discuss is the following. Also, in the framework of quantum mechanics, I want to discuss whether we can tell, without doing too much work, whether in a given system, in this case, this is a system with a Hamiltonian that has a given superpotential, because it determines everything for us, we want to learn whether we can tell, without doing too much work, as theorists, that's always our desire, right? Without doing too much work, we want to see whether we can learn whether the ground state of a given system is supersymmetric or not. And it turns out that we can learn something. And what we learn will be useful not just in quantum mechanics, but also in all higher dimensional field theories. So for a system, and again, supersymmetric quantum mechanical system, but actually even more general supersymmetric system, with given H, equivalent to W of X in this case, can we say something without actually solving the Schrodinger equation, without solving the system, about the properties of the ground state? In particular, we want to know whether a given system has a supersymmetric ground state or not. Does it have E equals zero or not? Which is equivalent to the question, is the ground state supersymmetric? This last question is important for applications in four dimensions, when you're interested in using some supersymmetric dynamics to dynamically break supersymmetry. Why you want to do that, separate issue, we can discuss it here. So it's a useful thing. It turns out we can, okay? We can simplify, turns out, in SUSY theories, a general criterion can be given. And it's based on the Witten index. Which we will introduce, but not yet. Let's consider back our system. For our system, it's pretty easy to discuss the properties of the ground state. The ground state for our system is obeys this equation. So if psi is a supersymmetric ground state, that has to be true, right? If psi is a SUSY ground state, above must hold. On the other hand, our Hamiltonian is the square of a Hermitian operator. This implies, and you will show that, that H psi equals zero, if and only if Qi on psi is zero. So to study the properties of the ground state, we need not study E equals zero solution of this equation. Now, I mean, this is the big simplification that supersymmetry affords us, right? What is the Hamiltonian? In the system, the Hamiltonian is a second order differential operator, right? Well, in second order differential equations are not so bad, but in any case, they are second order differential equations. There is a certain amount of work that you need to do to find out whether they have normalizable solutions with zero energy. On the other hand, this argument tells us that to study the zero energy states, it is sufficient to find normalizable solution, not to these solutions, not to this equation, but to this equation. And what is the difference between this equation and this equation? The difference is that this equation is second order, and this equation is first order. Well, first order equations even I can solve, right? Second order, a general one, I'm not so sure, right? So this is tremendous simplification. And it is a recurring theme in supersymmetry, you know, from 0 to 10 dimensions, as you will see in this lecture, in this school, if you haven't seen yet. Okay, so it's a tremendous simplification. Second order becomes first order. It's an amazing simplification. Of course, it's only true because there is a zero on the right-hand side, okay, which can be thought of as drawback. But in any case, for the study of the zero energy states, you can say a lot. More generally, let me just introduce some terminology. States that obey this for some subsets of superchargers are called BPS states. And you will hear that later. Okay, so let's study this equation in our system, back to our system. I'm doing good, actually. I'm happy. So let's look at this equation in our system. It'll teach us something. We can actually solve it for our system. It's not a big deal. Our system is pretty simple. So we can actually just write the differential equation that the wave function psi has to obey if it is to be a solution of the zero energy Schrodinger equation. So let's take Q1, for example. So this implies that acting on our and this I can show actually you can show that the solution is very simple. It's determined by the function W and two constants, C1 and C2. And so it's e to the w of x . So this is our solution of this equation. Know that I can always solve this equation, right? Can always solve it. The solution depends on two arbitrary constants. So you check it, please, okay? It involves some sigma algebra, very trivial one, okay? So that's good, but is it normalizable? And first of all, it's very easy to see that if C1 and C2 are both non-zero, then this is not normalizable, right? The norm that we're talking about is simply the modulus square of psi1 plus the modulus square of psi2 integrated over all x, right? So if both C1 and C2 are non-zero, it's clear that you're gonna run into a problem because one exponent comes with a minus and the other comes with a plus. So So this won't be normalizable in both limits. So when is it normalizable then? Well, if you take C1 equal to zero, then what you require is that e to the minus 2w sufficiently fast dies off when x goes to infinity so that this part is normalizable. If C2 is zero, then you require the e to the w dies off at infinity so that this part of the wave function is normalizable. So I'll write it down. There are two cases. One, if C1 equals zero, then what one wants is that W of X should go to infinity plus plus infinity as x goes to plus minus infinity, right? Because then e to the minus w will die off and the thing will be normalizable. And that means sufficiently fast. And if you're a mathematician, you study that, okay? And the two is if c2 is zero, then w of x should go to minus infinity as x goes to infinity. Because if c2 is zero, then this part should be normalizable, and you demand that this is a negative exponent when x goes to infinity, so that the corresponding integral goes to zero, converges. So these are the two states. And the conclusion here is that w has to be even at infinity. I can summarize it by saying even at infinity just means that it has the same limit, either plus infinity or minus infinity, at both and both x infinities. I'll draw some pictures. If w does not obey that, this argument is telling us that there is no normalizable state of zero energy, therefore supersymmetry is broken. So let's draw some pictures. You see how easy it was compared to actually solving the Schrodinger equation and looking for a zero energy solution of the second order equation, okay? So let's draw some picture. And it is a useful picture to get used between going between double and the potential. So here is a picture of, say, x and w. This is a w that obeys our criterion. Or this is another w, say, Morhams. Well, this is the superpotential. In physics, we are used to talking about the potential. So the potential is w prime squared of x. W prime for this function is zero at this point. And so the potential here looks something like this. So for this function, which is even at infinity, the potential has one minimum at zero energy. For this function, there are three critical points, and the potential has three zeros. This is just drawn very schematically, but what is important, it has three zeros, three minima zero energy. So our argument there tells us that in both these cases, there exists a normalizable ground state wave function. Moreover, we've given it explicitly what it is. What is more interesting? Well, let's draw a case where a normalizable ground state wave function of zero energy does not exist, and so supersymmetry is broken. So here is the case. And again, do I have two cases? Yes, I do have two cases here too, just to illustrate. One case is, for example, to have a W like this. This W is all at infinity. It has a different limit at plus and minus infinity for X. So this is W of X. And another one that I have is this one. This is another odd W. And now I draw the potential. This potential, this W doesn't have a critical point. The potential is W prime squared. So the potential in this case never vanishes. So it looks like this. You take the first derivative and you square it, and it will look something like this. Okay. In this case, there are two critical points. So W prime is zero here and here. And so the potential will vanish here and here. So the potential is like this. So here we have unbroken SUSY. And here we have SUSY broken. Um, So there is a difference between the two cases. What is the difference? So this is the classical, the potential of this quantum mechanical system that we have. So in this case, we stare at the quantum mechanical Hamiltonian, we look at the potential, and we find that the potential is never zero. So if we imagine doing some semi-classical quantization of this quantum mechanical system, we will be tempted to conclude already that at the leading semi-classical level, in this system, supersymmetry is broken because the potential is never zero, and you cannot have a zero energy state. Classically, if you put a particle, it will fall here, but this already is non-zero energy. So you conclude by staring at the classical system that supersymmetry in this system is broken. What is more interesting is this system. Because in this system, you actually have a classical zero energy state. You can put a zero energy particle here or here, and you may be tempted to conclude that, well, maybe in this system, actually, there exists a quantum mechanical state of zero energy. It turns out, no. Our argument tells us that if the potential has two zero energy minima, and more generally, an even number of zero energy minima, then supersymmetry in this system will be broken by quantum mechanical effects. By quantum mechanical effects, in this case, I mean just the exact solution of the Schrodinger equation. So this is teaching us an important lesson for the future in field theory. In this case, you can think of the leading semi-classical approximation to this quantum mechanical system as the three-level approximation in quantum field theory. So here we have an example of a theory where at three levels supersymmetry is unbroken. Because a zero energy state exists. And in fact, in this system, supersymmetry is unbroken to any order of perturbation theory. However, non-perturbatively, supersymmetry breaks. Non-perturbatively, in this case, you can take in two different ways. One way is that we actually solve the exact problem. So the exact solution is definitely non-perturbative. It's also possible in this system to study the effect of instantons and show that it is the instantons that, which is tunneling between these two minima, that lead to the fact that the ground state is lifted from zero energy. You would say, well, there are instantons here too. Well, it turns out that instantons, when there are three minima, don't lift the ground state energy, but they lift it when there's even number of minima. So this is teaching us that supersymmetric theories can exhibit dynamical supersymmetry breaking due to non-perturbative effects. And as a general motivation, in a supersymmetric system with a potential like this, you expect that for appropriately chosen parameters of the potential, tunneling is small, and the splitting, the lifting of the zero energy level to non-zero energy is also small. And because tunneling for, you know, tunneling rates are small, and the lifting of the zero energy level above zero should be proportional to the tunneling rate. Okay? Why am I saying that? The reason I'm saying that is that one of the issues that supersymmetric theories in four dimensions are supposed to address is the appearance of small scales in nature out of large scales. And this is sort of an example to that, where you have some characteristic frequency of motion in this well, which you can take to be the Planck scale, if you wish. And then you have some lifting of the energy level above zero, which is exponentially smaller than this scale, because tunneling is exponentially suppressed. And that could be the weak scale. Okay? So this is the sort of application that one has in mind of this kind of ideas. Yes? Oh, that's a very detailed question. Yes. Actually, well, yeah, we end up with one. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Yes. Yes, in this system, it's easy to say. Yes. Yes. So what have we learned? We learned that the supersymmetry can break non-perturbatively. Here's an example. And the behaviors of the superpotential at infinity can tell us whether this is at all possible or not. It's the behavior of the superpotential at infinity tells us whether a normalizable supersymmetric ground state exists or not. A lot of this persists in supersymmetric quantum field theory, and so I want to introduce some technology. The technology was introduced by Witten, and it's called the Witten index, and it's a very simple thing. At least it's very simple to introduce. It is less simple to calculate, but it is simple to introduce. The Witten index is simply the trace of this operator that we introduced before. And by a trace, I mean the usual thing. You take some complete set of states. You have a question? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not saying that this actually necessarily corresponds to some field theory. I was just making a general argument that there are field theories in which this can happen. In general, the question is difficult. Sorry? Yeah? Yeah? But you have to study the theory non-perturbatively, right? Yeah. Oh, you're talking about Weissmann models and stuff like that. Yeah. No, it's okay. Yeah. But this story here and the relation of the Witten index to the asymptotics of the superpotential here applies to quantum mechanics. I didn't tell you that this persists to the Weissmann model. In fact, it doesn't. No. You have to study. No, of course not. No. The analogy is only that it can happen. Absolutely. Yes. In a Weissmann model, in fact, it's first of all, W there is complex. Okay, and you have to study, a good analogy there is to study the quantum mechanics with complex W, which we haven't done, because it has four supercharges. And please, okay, I can do that, but, all right, yeah. No, there the story is different, okay, absolutely, yeah. There actually, okay, since you're asking, if the function actually has if W of phi has a critical point as a complex function, then there is no supersymmetry breaking. So there is always three level. If it breaks. So, but anyway, I wasn't pushing it that far. Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Actually, you have to be a little bit more careful, because what happens is the states are degenerates with the states with the Goldstino added. Okay? So, it is a little tricky. The Goldstino can have zero energy, and you can partner any state with the Goldstino. You see what I'm saying? Okay. So that actually holds. A zero energy Goldstino does not change the energy of any state. And so they're still doubly degenerate. You're not happy. That's a separate issue. Yes. You have any more? We're doing good, so feel free. So the Witten index is this thing. The trace is the trace over all states in Hilbert space, and I can take the states to be simply the energy eigenstates. And minus 1 to the f is plus 1 on bosonic states and minus 1 on fermionic states. So the Witten index simply sums over all energy levels the number of bosonic states of that energy minus the number of fermionic states of that energy. But then we discuss that all states with non-zero energy are paired. And so in this sum, only the E equals zero term will survive. Because all for non-zero energy, this equals this. So only this survives. So what can we conclude? If the Witten index is non-zero, right, because of this equality, it tells immediately that there is some state of zero energy. It's either bosonic or fermionic, or maybe there is both, but the difference is non-zero. So the implication of the Witten index is if trace minus 1 to the f is non-zero, then supersymmetry is unbroken. So in particular, if you have a theory, like some pure supersymmetric Young Mills in four dimensions, you can calculate the Witten index, and it was done by Witten again. And he found that the Witten index is equal to the rank plus one of the gauge group. So it's non-zero. And then you can argue that in those theories, pure super Young Mills, supersymmetry isn't broken. Okay, so that's the major utility of the Witten index. Now, it is less useful if the trace is zero, because you can have it either way. Right? It could be that both NB and NF are zero, but it could be that they're both non-zero and they cancel. So, in any case, if you have a field theory where you can calculate the Witten index and you show that it's non-zero, then you know for sure that Suzy isn't broken. But if it is zero, at least it's a candidate of a theory that can break supersymmetry. This Witten index is, well, relatively easy to calculate in many cases because it is an index. It is a topological quantity, and as such is invariant under continuous deformation of the theory. So let me try to discuss what that means. It's simple in the quantum mechanical case. In the quantum mechanical case, what we will mean by deformation of the theory is changing the superpotential of the theory. Right? Changing the superpotential in field theory is like changing the interactions of the theory because the superpotential determines the interaction. So if the change is continuous in a suitably well-defined sense, then we will argue that this Witten index does not change. So I'll try to illustrate what I mean now. It's best argued on an example. Let's consider the following theory. So here we have a ground state. And at the various levels, I will put circles which indicate how many states of that character there are. So consider this theory, which for some value of its interactions, say, has two fermionic and two bosonic ground states. And it has some non-zero energy levels. I'll assume it's a discrete spectrum. And they're all paired. It's something like this, et cetera. OK? Now, what is the Witten index of this theory? The Witten index of this theory is minus 1, because there is one bosonic ground state and two fermionic ground states. So 1 minus 2 is minus 1. The claim is that, then, that if you change the parameters of the theory, if you change the superpotential of that theory, what will happen? So changing the superpotential is like changing the potential. You're doing something. You're changing the coefficient of x to the 6. You're changing the Yukawa interactions. The energy levels will shift somehow, right? And it may also happen that some states which were at zero energy will not be at zero energy anymore, right? But what is important? It is important that you're changing the parameters of the theory, but it is at all times a supersymmetric theory, right? So it is at all times a supersymmetric theory, and therefore at all times, all non-zero energy levels have to be doubly degenerate. So the Witten index is focusing on the behavior of the E equals zero levels. So because the system is supersymmetric, the only thing that can happen is that these zero energy levels can become non-zero energy, but non-zero energy levels are always doubled, so they can only do so in pairs. So one thing that can happen is that this level and this level will become non-zero energy, but they have to do it simultaneously, because the moment they have non-zero energy, they're paired. Or it can happen that this level and this level will descend to zero energy, but at the same time, they have to do it, similarly, they have to do it in pairs, because at non-zero energy, they're degenerate, and so they can leave or become zero energy in pairs. So levels can leave or arrive at in pairs only. So one possible thing that can happen is that you end up with no bosonic and one fermionic state, and this is a zero energy. And you have, you know, something, some complicated diagrams for the higher levels. It doesn't matter. But because they can leave or arrive at zero energy only in pairs, this means that the index is not changed, because a pair of a bosonic and a fermionic state don't change the index. If I had a system where I only had one bosonic and one fermionic state, this would be the Witten index zero, then it could be that both of them would leave zero energy as you deform the potential of the theory. Right? So in that case, it is completely consistent that for some values of the parameters, supersymmetry can break, and for some values of the parameters, it will be unbroken. It will be unbroken. Yes. In fact, there are simple theories like that. Yes. We will discuss that in a moment. Yes. By a continuous deformation of the theory, you can change the parameters in the potential, but what you're not allowed to change is the asymptotics of the superpotential at infinity. So I'll give you an example. So let's consider these examples. So in this example, the Witten index is zero. Oops. Yes. Yeah. 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 You have to be, you're thinking in terms of the supersymmetric oscillator. Your thinking is too limited. In the supersymmetric oscillator, you simply don't have the fermionic ground states. Yes, but in a in the interacting system, as I showed you, we defined fermion number very carefully. I forgot already which one we defined, but I showed you that for a choice of the superpotential, it can be either the upper or the lower component of the wave function. So that's what you mean by the fermion. Yes. Yes. No? No, it applies for everything. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. You shouldn't be constrained by your perturbative thinking. Okay? It applies to everything, absolutely. How did we arrive at the condition that the superpotential will be even at infinity? We arrived by looking at the condition that cube psi is zero, except it was for an interacting system, right? Yeah, okay. So for our examples, in this case, the Witten index is zero. This one is also. Here the Witten index is 1. So what would it mean to deform a potential like this to a potential like this? Right? Look at the superpotential. I would have to take this superpotential, which is a function even at infinity, right, and take this and somehow at large x bring it this way, to get from this to this. All right? This is not a continuous deformation. This involves changing the asymptotics of the function at infinity of the superpotential. Okay? So it changes the index, of course. So about quantum field theory, the Witten index has been calculated. Actually, it has been calculated in many field theories. But the most interesting example for application is pure super Young Mills. Well, I'm assuming that you have an idea of what pure super Young Mills is. It's basically QCD with Weyl fermions in the edge joint. That's what it is. And trace minus 1 to the F is R plus 1, where R is the rank of the group. So for SU2, R is 1, for SU3 is 2, and so on. And this was done by Witten. And so this argument assures you that in this theory, supersymmetry is unbroken. So if you're looking for a theory that behaves like this, namely it has supersymmetry breaking due to non-perturbative effects, you have to look at something more complicated than pure super-Young mills. In particular, you have to add some meta fields and study complicated interactions and so on and so forth. One word about the calculation. The calculation in this theory was done effectively at weak coupling, and weak coupling was achieved by putting the theory in a box and taking the size of the box to be smaller than the QCD strong coupling scale. And then you can solve the theory perturbatively, and because the coupling is weak. And you can study the dynamics of the zero modes and come up with this result. And yes, and then there are other arguments in purely four-dimensional infinite volume ones that confirm this from other sources. Yes. Yeah. In some cases, yes, and in some cases, no. And the best I can do is to refer you to Witten's paper. The cases where you can do it are limited, yes. And I cannot answer that now. Yeah.
If in the case, if you calculate a specific case, say, with that potential.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Well, for this model, probably yes. But there are cases in which no. For example, an example is a supersymmetry breaking with Fayet-Leopoldus terms in four dimensions, where varying the Fayet-Leopoldus term does not change the asymptotics of the potential at infinity, and yet you go from breaking to non-breaking. So, and the index is zero all the time. So that's the simplest example that I can think of. Yes. I'm sorry? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I can refer you to a very nice book. It is about 1,000 pages. It's called Mirror Symmetry. And no, but forget about the 1,000 pages. But yes, there is a lot of that. Absolutely. Yes. And one person who can tell you here is Brian. Okay, he's Cantara's student. He can tell you all about the cohomology of the supercharges and this and that. Yes, there is a very rich structure. So I think we're actually done for today. Okay? We learned a lot, and I got to page 18, which is good. So what we're going to do tomorrow, I think it's tomorrow, yes? Tomorrow, what we're going to do is switch gears. Okay? Then we introduce this machinery, which you will use somewhere. Okay? I'm sure of that. Tomorrow, we're going to switch gears. And we're going to start from this quantum mechanical theory, which we defined using a Hamiltonian. We're going to write it as a quantum field theory in one dimension. Okay? If you write a Lagrangian for a quantum mechanical theory, you have a field which is x of t, and you will have some fermion field psi of t. And the question that we will ask is how to write the most general Lagrangian of that theory, which is supersymmetric. This will lead us to the notion of superfields and all kinds of fun stuff, and it will be very useful for us. And for higher dimensions. So that's what we'll do tomorrow. So there will be some technology involved. And if you have more questions, just get me. I'll be around.